workforce in government. After half a century, our people still have the ability to surprise me with their ingenuity, their brilliance, and their commitment to mission. And I will miss our mission. Those are the things I'll miss most, the people and the mission. Finally, I said that before I shuffle off the stage, since I've got one foot in assisted living already, I wanted to answer one frequently asked question. Are we better? As in, are we better than we were before I started as DNI or before 9/11 changed the way we do business? Well, one upshot to achieving intelligence geezerdom is that I tend to look back even farther. I've got a lot more data points. And so the question I ask myself is, are we better now than we were when I was a young intelligence officer in 1963? The answer to that is a resounding yes. We're more efficient. We collect more, with more accesses and more tools at our disposal. Our technology is astounding, and we can put intelligence into the hands of deployed warfighters in real time, whereas we used to be days or weeks time late. We are organized completely differently. We are a community, while 50 years ago, CIA and NSA might as well have been on two different planets. We, of course, haven't reached integration nirvana, but we've come a long way on that journey, and we've also, over the past few years, learned to embrace transparency. Well, embrace may be a strong word, but just a few years ago, transparency felt genetically antithetical to me, and it doesn't feel that way now. And the result of all that progress is that we're more effective at reducing risk for our national decision makers. Of course, policymakers have the option of accepting or rejecting the insight that intelligence gives them. If they reject it, they do so at their own peril, and unfortunately, at the peril of the nation, too. So, what do? We keep on keeping on, doing the work of the intelligence business. The president-elect seemed increasingly desperate to make the story of Russian interference go away, constantly denying there had been any impact on the election or any interference at all. On December 28th, he said that it was time for the country to move on to bigger and better things. President Obama didn't want to focus on the Russian issue during his final weeks in office either, but he wasn't simply going to move on. On December 29th, he ordered new sanctions against Russia and declared 35 known Russian spies in the United States to be persona non grata and sent them home. He also closed the two Russian-owned facilities in Maryland and New York. I didn't think that response was commensurate with what they'd done to us, but I also knew we weren't prepared to take more drastic steps. We waited to see how Putin would respond, fully expecting a reciprocal retaliation. The same day, as was confirmed when he later pled guilty to lying to the FBI about it, National Security Advisor designate Mike Flynn called Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, assuring him not to worry about the sanctions and asking that Russia not retaliate. On the following day, Putin announced he would not expel anyone from Russia and would not respond in kind to the new U.S. sanctions, saying he would wait to work with the next U.S. presidential administration. Trump tweeted, "Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart." New Year's Day fell on Sunday, and so Monday, January 2nd, was a scheduled government holiday. The IC assessment team did not take the day off, and neither did I, as the most highly classified version of the assessment was due to the president on Thursday. John, Mike, Jim, and I, along with our closest trusted senior staff members, gave the draft assessment a critical read. We agreed that after we briefed President Obama on Thursday, we would brief President-elect Trump on Friday and provide a still classified but less sensitive version to Congress. Then the team would have the weekend to redact the sensitive aspects of the classified version, so that we could publish an unclassified assessment on Monday, January 9th. We also agreed that the three versions of the assessment, including the version we published, would contain the same conclusions, word for word. Our team of subject matter experts cross-referenced independent sources across disciplines, each corroborating the others and each adding to the big picture, enriching what we knew about the scope and scale of Russia's efforts. I remember just how staggering the assessment felt the first time I read it through from start to finish, and just how specific our conclusions and evidence were. We showed unambiguously that Putin had ordered the campaign to influence the election, that the campaign was multifaceted, and that Russia had used cyber espionage against U.S. political organizations and publicly disclosed the data they collected through WikiLeaks, DC Leaks, and the Guccifer 2.0 persona. We documented Russian cyber intrusions into state and local voter rolls. We described Russia's pervasive propaganda efforts through RT, Sputnik, and the social media trolls, and how the entire operation had begun with attempts to undermine U.S. democracy and demean Secretary Clinton, then shifted to promoting Mr. Trump when Russia assessed he was a viable candidate who would serve their strategic goals. We added historical context to show just how much of an unprecedented escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort all of this represented, and we assessed that the election operation signaled a new normal in Russian influence efforts. The Russian government had done all of this at minimal cost and without significant damage to their own interests, and they had no real incentive to stop. On Tuesday, President-elect Trump attempted to undercut our assessment before its release, tweeting, "The intelligence briefing on so-called Russian hacking was delayed until Friday. Perhaps more time needed to build a case. Very strange." Of course, it had never been the plan to give him the assessment before it went to President Obama, but we chose not to respond to his tweet. On Wednesday, he tweeted, "Julian Assange said a 14-year-old could have hacked Podesta. Why was DNC so careless? Also said Russians did not give him the info." We again ignored the provocation, and I hoped the intelligence briefer who continued to present president's daily briefs to the president-elect wasn't being shot as the messenger. I continued my Oval Office sessions with President Obama through all of this. On Tuesday, 2 days before the assessment was due to him, he was calm, patient, and supportive, never pressing me for details before the report was ready. That stood in stark contrast to Congress. Almost as soon as the president assigned us the task of studying the Russian interference on December 5th, our oversight committees began demanding we give them updates on our progress. It's the only time I can recall ever giving Congress a flat no without making any attempt to compromise or deflect the contrived ire of their demands. We certainly didn't want the partisan congressional guidance that would have come as a result of briefing them, nor did we want anything to interfere with the team preparing the assessment, which leaks of their work certainly would have done. Even within the White House Situation Room, during the month it took to put the assessment together, we took extraordinary measures when discussing Russian interference, procedures comparable to those invoked during the endgame of the hunt for bin Laden. One senator did find a way around our efforts to keep Congress out of our work until we'd briefed the president. John McCain informed my office in December that he wanted to hold a final hearing on foreign cyber threats before I retired. He said that the session would not be about the Russian interference, but instead would cover a broad look at cybersecurity. My office knew that even if that was genuinely his intent, the other senators on the committee would undoubtedly inquire about the assessment. McCain assured me he wouldn't let that happen, but when, still dubious, my office continued to try to deflect the invitation, Senator McCain defaulted to his favorite persuasive technique and said that if I didn't agree to appear voluntarily, he'd subpoena me. For reasons that escape me now, we not only agreed to do the hearing, but scheduled it for Thursday morning, a morning I would normally brief the president in the Oval, and the very day that we would be delivering our assessment on Russian interference to him. Preparing for that hearing was just about the last thing on my mind that week. Not only were the three directors and I poring over the IC assessment for any flaw, any reason why the president-elect, his team, Congress, or anyone else could call its conclusions into question, we were also settling on how we would actually present it. We'd decided in the interests of consistency that no matter whom we were briefing, we'd use the same set of talking points. I would serve as the moderator, and we'd mark out specific cues for Mike, Jim, and John to amplify our talking points by briefing the NSA, FBI, and CIA equities in the assessment in that specific order. Our mantra was, "That's our story, and we're sticking to it." Of course, we couldn't have believed in that mantra if we weren't confident in the superb work the IC assessment team had done and the meticulous reviews we were continuing to put their work through. We conducted a walkthrough of our presentation, and by Wednesday night, January 4th, we were ready, and we sent a copy of the assessment to the White House so that the president could read it before we met with him. Then, having seen on Twitter a preview of how the president-elect would characterize and attempt to dismiss the assessment, and anticipating what would happen if he had a full weekend to tweet and talk about it before we released the public version, we made a difficult request of the overworked IC assessment team. We asked them to start working on the unclassified version immediately and to have it ready by Friday morning instead of Monday, so that we could release the public assessment as soon as we finished briefing the president-elect that afternoon. On Thursday morning, despite all of my best efforts to avoid it, I found myself once again behind the witness table in the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing room. Before the hearing started, my staff had warned the committee staff that I would be traveling directly from the hearing room to the White House to brief the IC assessment to the president. Chairman McCain therefore knew that I was leaving the hearing at noon, and that trying to extend the hearing past then risked an awkward scene. Also, while the assessment was complete and we no longer were concerned about congressional interference, we strongly wished to avoid discussing what was in it before we'd briefed the president and his successor. After welcoming the senators who were new to the committee in the recently elected Congress and welcoming us as witnesses, McCain explained why we were gathered. In two sentences, he succinctly stated the difficulty our nation faced. "This hearing is about the broad range of cybersecurity challenges confronting our nation, threats from countries like Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, as well as non-state actors from terrorist groups to transnational criminal organizations. In recent years, we have seen a growing series of cyber attacks by multiple actors, attacks that have targeted our citizens, businesses, military, and government." Having kept his promise that the hearing would broadly address foreign cyber threats, McCain moved to the topic on everyone's mind as I kept a poker face. "But there is no escaping the fact that this committee meets today for the first time in this new Congress in the aftermath of an unprecedented attack on our democracy. At the president's direction, Director Clapper is leading a comprehensive review of Russian interference in our recent election, with the goal of informing the American people as much as possible about what happened." Continuing his opening remarks, Chairman McCain both relieved the most distinct point of anxiety among Republican legislators and the president-elect's transition team, and at the same time deftly let us off the hook for the most controversial line of questioning we'd expected to face. "The goal of this review, as I understand it," he stated, "is not to question the outcome of the presidential election, nor should it be." Then he explained what we would release the following day, saying we needed to move forward with full knowledge of the facts, and that, without previewing the assessment, we know a lot already. He concluded, "Every American should be alarmed by Russia's attacks on our nation. There is no national security interest more vital to the United States of America than the ability to hold free and fair elections without foreign interference. That is why Congress must set partisanship aside, follow the facts, and work together." In fairness to Chairman McCain, over the next 2.5 hours, we did occasionally discuss cyber-related topics other than Russian interference, and despite my having been strongly opposed to testifying that morning, his insistence on holding this hearing ended up doing us a huge favor. It served to introduce the scope of the assessment to the public, media, and Congress in a thoughtful manner that ran counter to the president-elect's tweets. And more important, the hearing gave us an opportunity to demonstrate that the IC assessment wasn't a politically motivated witch hunt, and that we hadn't conducted the assessment simply because President Obama didn't like the results of the election. The discussion that followed was at times circumspect and often tense, but it afforded us an opportunity to discuss aspects of what had happened during the run-up to the election that our assessment did not cover. Chairman McCain returned several times to lambasting Julian Assange. At one point, he asked me directly, "Director Clapper, how would you describe Mr. Assange?" "Well," I replied, "he is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because he is under indictment, I believe by the Swedish government, for a sexual crime. He has, in the interests of ostensibly openness and transparency, exposed and put people at risk by his doing that. So I do not think those of us in the intelligence community have a whole lot of respect for him." Mike simply said, "I would echo those comments." In another exchange, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan challenged me on the seemingly unforceful U.S. response to the Chinese hacks of OPM's systems, asking, "But is that answer not part of the problem, that we are showing that we are not going to make it costly for them to come in and steal the files of 22 million Americans, including many intelligence officers?" I responded with a truth-to-power answer I suspect he didn't want to hear. "Well, as I say, people who live in glass houses need to think about throwing rocks, because this was an act of espionage, and we and other nations conduct similar acts of espionage. So if we're going to punish each other for acts of espionage, that is a different policy issue." A few minutes later, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham returned to the point, noting how similar the sanctions in response to Russia's actions were to those issued in response to China's. "Is there a difference between espionage and interfering in an election?" he asked me. "Yes," I responded. "Espionage implies, to me at least, a passive collection, and this was much more activist." He led me down a road that, for a change, I was comfortable walking. "So when it comes to espionage, we better be careful about throwing rocks. When it comes to interfering in our election, we better be ready to throw rocks. Do you agree with that?" "That is a good metaphor," I agreed. He concluded with a line he knew would be replayed on all the cable news networks. "I think what Obama did was throw a pebble. I am ready to throw a rock." The hearing also gave me an opportunity to address a topic that had been on my mind since December 9th, when the president-elect had first attacked the IC. Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill broached it by asking if it was important that we maintain the intelligence community as a foundational, apolitical block of our country. "I could not feel stronger about exactly that," I responded. "I think it is hugely important that the intelligence community conduct itself and be seen as independent, providing unvarnished, untainted, objective, accurate, and timely and relevant intelligence support to all policymakers, commanders, diplomats, etc." She continued, "Do in fact members of the intelligence community engage in life-threatening and very dangerous missions every day, particularly as it relates to the war on terror? You only need to walk into the lobby of CIA and look at the stars on the wall or the front lobby of NSA to see the number of intelligence people that have paid the ultimate price in service of their country," I replied. Then she got to the heart of what had been bothering me so much, expressing what I, as DNI, could not say. "So let us talk about who benefits from a president-elect trashing the intelligence community. Who benefits from that, Director Clapper? The American people? them losing confidence in the intelligence community and the work of the intelligence community? Who actually is the benefactor of someone who is about to become commander-in-chief, trashing the intelligence community? I tried to be circumspect with my response. I think there is an important distinction here between healthy skepticism, which policymakers, to include policymaker number one, should always have for intelligence. But I think there is a difference between skepticism and disparagement. The hearing adjourned at 12:09, after Chairman McCain and I sparred, playfully, I think, each of us in cranky old man mode. Before gaveling the hearing to a close, he said, "Director Clapper, we will be calling you again." Breaching etiquette, I keyed my microphone back on to retort, "Really?" My detail hustled me out of the hearing room and into the SUV. Just ahead of Mike Rogers' team, we raced down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. Mike and I ran in, meeting John Brennan and Jim Comey, and together the four of us discussed the IC assessment with the president, who was somber and appreciative. I've often wondered what would have happened, or more to the point, what wouldn't have happened, if President Obama hadn't tasked us specifically to gather all the intelligence reporting on the Russian interference into one report, or if we'd still been working in a culture in which CIA, NSA, and FBI refused to share information with each other, as they'd been accused of doing in the summer of 2001. Without that IC assessment, I don't know that all the subsequent congressional investigations would have been launched. The Senate Intelligence Committee started its investigation the day after we briefed them, followed shortly by the Senate Judiciary, House Intelligence, and House Oversight and Government Reform Committees. Likewise, I don't know if the FBI's investigation would have been so threatening as to provoke President Trump to fire Jim Comey in May, or to prompt Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from Russia-related matters, and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to appoint Robert Mueller as special counsel. On Thursday night, the team worked through the details of the still highly classified version for Congress and the unclassified version we intended to publish Friday afternoon. At 8:30 on Friday morning, we were back on Capitol Hill, presenting our briefing to the Gang of Eight, the party leaders in the House and Senate, and the chairs and ranking members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. Our presentation was fast-paced and terse, as we had to leave by 9:30 to stay on schedule. I departed the Capitol with the impression that the leaders of both parties were taken aback, both by the extent of the Russian operation and by the thoroughness with which we documented the facts and evidence. Jim, John, Mike, and I departed the Capitol on time, all of us and our personal security details in four separate, specially configured, up-armored SUVs, and sped across the Anacostia River to Andrews Air Force Base. John, Mike, and I boarded one plane, and Jim, who'd planned to remain in New York and meet with employees in FBI offices there after briefing the president-elect, boarded another. We landed at Newark International Airport around 11:30, where another four SUVs equipped with flashing lights were waiting on the tarmac to whisk us across the Hudson River to Manhattan and Trump Tower. With the media camped out in the lobby on the business side of the building, we took the residential entrance, which was fairly quiet, with only a few doormen and porters in the hallway who all ducked aside as we passed. I briefly wondered if 20 or so government men in dark suits walking briskly through the residential hallway was an odd sight, or something to which they had already grown accustomed. Security officers held each elevator as we ascended to the 14th floor, crossed over to the business side, and ascended again. We transited a busy hallway, bustling with people I assumed were working on the transition, and finally reached the conference room where we were to brief the president-elect, a small and windowless space which we were told had been secured as a SCIF, a sensitive, compartmented information facility, by the Secret Service. Eight chairs were arranged around a table with another row along a wall. As the de facto leader of our four-man delegation, I posted myself by the door, and we waited for the president-elect. After about 10 minutes, he walked in, smiling. When I extended my hand and introduced myself, he laughed and said, "I know who you are." He told me I had done a great job testifying the previous day, which seemed a diplomatic gesture, considering I hadn't been all that complimentary of him during the hearing, and he concluded, "You looked good on TV." That final bit of flattery was a compliment I'm sure I've never heard before. I thanked him, while asserting that I actually have a face made for radio. He thanked me for the letter I'd sent along with his initial President's Daily Brief, the first of 3 times he brought up the letter during the meeting. His pleasant, courteous attitude was a relief and set the tone for an affable briefing. President-elect Trump and Vice President-elect Pence sat at opposite ends of the table. I sat to Trump's immediate left with John Brennan beside me. Mike Rogers and Jim Comey sat across from us. National Security Advisor-designate Mike Flynn and White House Chief of Staff-designate Reince Priebus took the remaining 2 seats at the table to either side of Pence. This arrangement was much friendlier than if the 4 of us had been seated at one side of the table and Trump's team on the other, and as such felt more like a standard intelligence briefing than one of the tense negotiations for which Trump was famous. As we got settled, CIA Director nominee Mike Pompeo, Deputy National Security Advisor-designate K.T. McFarland, and Homeland Security Advisor-designate Tom Bossert took seats along the wall, along with Trump's PDB briefer, for whom the president-elect had high praise. After we started briefing, White House Press Secretary-designate Sean Spicer joined in, taking one of the wall seats. We briefed virtually the same content we'd given the Gang of Eight that morning, with me as the lead presenter and Mike, Jim, and John delivering their amplifying parts on cue. While the material was the same, the whole session was more relaxed, and we took our time to explain terms and intelligence procedures with which we knew the group might not be familiar. The briefing remained professional, but conversational, too, and the president-elect and vice president-elect both interjected politely. Trump appropriately questioned some evidence and conclusions, and we answered his questions to his apparent satisfaction. Pence very astutely prompted us to clarify points on several occasions. I was impressed by the way he actively consumed the intelligence we were providing. We were scheduled to spend an hour in Trump Tower, but the meeting lasted an hour and a half. By the end, I believe everyone in the room realized that the evidence, particularly from signals intelligence and cyber forensics, to attribute the influence operation to Vladimir Putin and the Russian government was overwhelming. The entire Trump team was happy to hear our assessment that the Russians had not successfully tampered with actual vote tallies. The only question they posed that we couldn't answer was whether the Russian influence operation had any effect on the outcome of the election. I told the president-elect that we had neither the authority nor capabilities to assess what impact, if any, the Russian operation had. As we closed the briefing, Jim Comey took advantage of a pause in conversation to address the president-elect. We'd agreed that one of the 2 of us would bring up one additional matter, a subject best discussed on a one-on-one basis with the president-elect. The additional matter was a dossier, a collection of 17 pseudo-intelligence reports created by a private company, which I first learned about from John Brennan a week or so after we'd been tasked to conduct the IC assessment. I didn't know until after my tenure as DNI that the dossier had begun as opposition research against Mr. Trump during the Republican primary race and then, sponsored by the Democrats, had continued to expand during the general election campaign. The memos covered a wide range of topics, all related to long-standing interactions between Trump, his associates, and the Russians. It further alleged that the Russian government had compromising material on the president-elect and his team, which it had not disclosed during the course of the election or since. Some details in the report were salacious, but in our professional opinions, the more ominous accounts alleged ties between members of the Trump team and the Russian government. Because we had not corroborated any of the sources used to generate the dossier, we had not included it as part of our IC assessment. We knew that at least two congressional members and some of the media had copies of the dossier, and that it could be published, in whole or in part, at any moment. While we could neither confirm nor refute anything in the document, we felt what I expressed as a duty to warn the president-elect that it existed and that it potentially could be made public. I wondered at the time, and have often done so since, what the reaction would have been had we not warned the president-elect about the existence of the dossier, and he later learned we had known about it and chosen not to tell him. We decided that it should be Jim to brief him about the matter for two reasons. First, the FBI had first uncovered the dossier in its earlier investigation into the Russian hacking of Clinton campaign emails. And second, John and I were both retiring at noon on January 20th, while Jim would continue on as FBI director for President Trump. We all rose, and President-elect Trump thanked us. Reince Priebus asked him if he wanted anyone on his team to stay for the additional matter, and the president-elect said no. So, leaving the two of them to talk, the rest of the party adjourned. Before we cleared the conference room, the Trump team had already begun drafting their press release about our meeting. I overheard their first point that the USIC had assessed that the Russian interference did not change the outcome of the election, which was very different than our acknowledgement that we hadn't and couldn't assess its impact. We had to let it pass. In the hallway, I took the opportunity to engage Tom Bossert, who in turn introduced me to the vice president-elect. I spoke with them briefly, suggesting that the new administration consider asking Nick Rasmussen to stay on as director of the National Counterterrorism Center, which it did. In the car on the way back to Newark Airport, I called Brian Hale, who only requested to be described as tanned and rested if we mentioned him in this book, and told him to publish the unclassified IC assessment immediately. He replied that just minutes before he'd received the certified as unclassified version of the report as it was moved onto the ODNI system connected to the Internet, and it was ready to go. Cutting the phone connection and sitting back, I felt just about as far from tanned and rested as one can get. My personal vision of dancing quietly off the stage while no one was paying attention had dissolved. I had less than 14 days left on the job, and we still had hearings to get through with our oversight committees and each of the full houses of Congress within the next week. So far, I imagined, or hoped, that we appeared publicly to be like the proverbial duck gliding smoothly across the pond, but I could feel just how frantically we were kicking our legs beneath the surface. After we landed at Andrews, I called White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough to let him know that not only had we survived the briefing, but it had gone surprisingly well. I got little rest over the weekend, both because I was preparing for the hearings and because I was running out of time to close on several important to the IC issues before the clock ran out on January 20th. Early Monday morning, I was on camera once again, this time under very different circumstances. Every 4 years, just ahead of Inauguration Day, our National Intelligence Council publishes its Global Trends Report, an unclassified strategic assessment of how key trends and uncertainties might shape the world over the next 20 years to help senior U.S. leaders think about and plan for the longer term. Global Trends represents years of work from our most strategically minded analysts, and I took a lot of pride in introducing the program of presentations planned for that day. After advising the media and the spray of cameras to chuckles, "If you're here to get the latest on the Russia hacks, you're in the wrong place," I explained that the Global Trends Report does not represent the official coordinated view of the U.S. intelligence community. It does not represent the official view or policy of the U.S. government, and it's not a prediction of the future. Instead, it was, I told them, a framework for thinking about the world designed to help each new administration. The report we published on January 9, 2017, was titled Paradox of Progress, and depicted a world at a crossroads, with rising tensions within and between countries. It forecast an ever-widening range of states, organizations, and empowered individuals will shape geopolitics. For better and worse, the emerging global landscape is drawing to a close an era of American dominance following the Cold War. So, too, perhaps is the rules-based international order that emerged after World War II. It will be much harder to cooperate internationally and govern in ways publics expect. Veto players will threaten to block collaboration at every turn, while information echo chambers will reinforce countless competing realities, undermining shared understandings of world events. Underlying this crisis in cooperation will be local, national, and international differences about the proper role of government across an array of issues ranging from the economy to the environment, religion, security, and the rights of individuals. Debates over moral boundaries, to whom is owed what, will become more pronounced, while divergence in values and interests among states will threaten international security. It will be tempting to impose order on this apparent chaos, but that ultimately would be too costly in the short run and would fail in the long. Dominating, empowered, proliferating actors in multiple domains would require unacceptable resources in an era of slow growth, fiscal limits, and debt burdens. Doing so domestically would be the end of democracy, resulting in authoritarianism or instability, or both. The paradox was that within this dark vision, there were unprecedented opportunities to reshape our world for the better, all dependent on how individuals, governments, and international groups renegotiated their expectations of and obligations to one another. The report raised profound questions based on years of diligent research and engagement with novel thinkers around the globe. In any sane world, I would have spent weeks preparing for the speech that morning and would have framed many of my final public engagements as D&I around the milestone report. Given the events of the past year and my continuing responsibility to report on the Russian operation against our election, I almost felt caught in a microcosm of the dark world the report described. So, that Monday, I gave my introductory speech, thanked the team who'd created the report, and departed for a farewell town hall at DHS, and then to prepare for additional Russia interference briefings with Mike, Jim, and John. On Tuesday morning, we were back on Capitol Hill. At 10 o'clock, we briefed the House Intelligence Committee in a classified, closed hearing, a gathering that turned partisan, personal, and nasty. In particular, three of the Republican lawmakers challenged our conclusion that the Russians actively supported Trump and seemed to resent that we had not involved them in the creation of the IC assessment or informed them as soon as we had any new information. Our explanations only served to stoke their anger. The briefing ran past schedule, and we hurried from the House briefing room south of the Capitol to a hearing room in an office building north of the Capitol for an open, televised hearing with the Senate Intelligence Committee. We had about a 20-minute break before the red lights went on above the cameras. For the next 2 hours, as the American public, Russian government, and rest of the world watched, we answered questions about the Russian cyber and influence operation. The senators and simultaneously the media sought to parse our every word. Democrats looking for collusion between Trump's team and the Russians, Republicans for evidence of a conspiracy that the IC was attempting to undermine the president-elect. Senators on both sides pressed Jim Comey to reveal whether there were open FBI investigations looking into either of the presidential campaigns. The Democrats certainly remembered the letter Jim had sent to the Hill 11 days before the election about reopening its investigation into Clinton's emails. when Jim told Senator Angus King, "Especially in a public forum, we never confirm or deny a pending investigation." King voiced quiet exasperation, and the left-leaning media outlets were left apoplectic. When the red lights went off, we immediately moved with the Senate committee to their secure facility. Strangely, after answering questions about it for 2 hours in public, we then presented the IC assessment to the committee for the first time. By the time this session ended, we'd been testifying for 7 straight hours. When I finally had the free time to check on world events, I found that all the contentiousness of the hearings and briefings had been completely overshadowed by other breaking news. BuzzFeed had published the now infamous dossier on Trump, the one that Jim had warned the president-elect about 5 days earlier. In a classic case of shoot the messenger, Trump publicly blamed us for the publication of the dossier, yet another indication to me that his administration would not appreciate anyone speaking truth to power, particularly if the truth was politically inconvenient. I woke Wednesday to find that Trump had tweeted another early morning attack on us. Intelligence agencies should never have allowed this fake news to leak into the public. One last shot at me. Are we living in Nazi Germany? I was floored by the analogy, and Jewish communities in the United States and abroad called for him to apologize and retract the statement. That afternoon in my office, I watched the president-elect in a televised news conference, doubling down on his Nazi tweet, again alleging that U.S. intelligence agencies had allowed the dossier to leak, as though we had any control over a document we'd discovered already out in the wild. He continued, "I think it's a disgrace, and I say that, and I say that, and that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do." Not helping the situation, the New York Times quickly published a story apparently intended to clarify that he meant to refer to U.S. intelligence as the Stasi, not the Gestapo. As I was leaving the office for the drive to the NRO for a farewell town hall, I asked Stephanie Sherline to see if she could track down a phone number for Trump. Much to my surprise, several minutes later, she told me the president-elect agreed to speak with me later that afternoon. Connecting from the NRO, I thanked him for taking the call and said he'd gotten my attention when he'd referred to the IC as Nazis. I explained to him that I wanted to defend the men and women of the intelligence community. I tried to appeal to his higher instincts and reiterated the points from my Election Day letter, that he was inheriting a national treasure and that the men and women of the IC wanted only to serve the nation and to make him successful as president. He thanked me and said that he valued the IC and the intelligence he'd been receiving. He then asked if I would put out a statement refuting what was in the dossier. The request felt very transactional, that he would play nice if I would do him a favor. I declined, saying that I couldn't refute or affirm what was in the dossier. He sounded disappointed. On Thursday, Mike, Jim, John, and I briefed the entire Senate, and on Friday morning, the entire House. To accommodate the many of its 435 members who showed up, we gave the House presentation in an auditorium in the Capitol Visitor Center. After the briefing, the chair and ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes and Adam Schiff, facilitated questions, with Republicans lined up at a microphone in the aisle on one side of the auditorium and Democrats on the other. The questions were mostly partisan, from both sides, and we did our best to answer them within the scope of our IC assessment. When Adam Schiff recognized Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, what followed was one of the more uncomfortable, dramatic, emotional displays I've witnessed on Capitol Hill. She ripped into Jim Comey over the hacking, the investigations, and the letter to the committees, channeling all of the frustration she'd felt since stepping down as DNC chair into a litany of allegations aimed at him. In the midst of so much chaos, partisanship, and controversy, her emotional anguish was palpable. I truly admired Jim for responding calmly. I tried to think of something I could say to defuse the exchange, but I couldn't. I traveled from the capital to NSA headquarters, where I held my final town hall with the workforce there, thanking them for their quiet service through all the controversies of the past few years, and trying to reassure them about the future. That evening, when I arrived back at the office, Stephanie Sherline took a long look at me, and for the first time in 6.5 years said, "You look tired." On Monday morning, the final week of the Obama presidency, I attended an NSC meeting that was neither celebratory nor valedictory. We discussed a difficult national security matter the president needed input on, and conveyed our thoughts and departmental positions to him. I spent the next few days focusing on writing performance evaluations and lining up awards and other forms of recognition for the people who'd worked with me the past few years, who all so richly deserved them. On Tuesday, I had lunch at the CIA. John then hosted a wonderful send-off with the staff in The Bubble, CIA's auditorium, featuring a video with clips of me delivering all my well-worn one-liners and geezer jokes. That evening, I thanked the airlift operations team that had arranged my transportation all over the world for 6 years, including to North Korea. I pinned a medal on the uniform of the enlisted Air Force non-commissioned officer who'd coordinated much of that travel, although what he really deserved was retroactive hazardous duty pay for his endless patience with me. On Wednesday, I visited DIA for a farewell town hall there, and then met with former Senator Dan Coats, who had been named in the media as my likely successor as DNI. I'd first encountered Dan when he'd served as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He understood intelligence oversight, but wanted to know more about the day-to-day details of the job, and I didn't hold back. Dan is a very decent man whose belief in truth to power made him a solid choice to be DNI, and after our discussion, he took the job with his eyes wide open. Later, I presented an award to Mike Dempsey, who had succeeded Robert Cardillo as deputy DNI for intelligence integration, and who would serve as acting DNI after Stephanie and I departed on Friday. That evening, I attended a final National Security Council meeting, at which we continued conducting business. The president thanked us all for our service and said he was proud of what we'd accomplished and that he'd miss us. On Thursday, I co-signed with Attorney General Lynch, after some 7 years of staff work, a directive that allowed for greater sharing of raw signals intelligence, the actual intercepts before they'd been processed, outside of NSA. It required quite a bit of compromise from the SIGINT professionals at NSA to accomplish, but it was another big step for intelligence integration. I met with the cross-agency team that had produced the IC assessment on Russian interference and thanked them for what they'd done for our nation, and at the request of the ODNI workforce, Stephanie and I set aside an hour before lunch to pose for pictures with the staff, the people who were so instrumental to any success we'd achieved in integrating intelligence. ODNI's public affairs team set up a red carpet backdrop, and we ended up staying for 2.5 hours. That evening, the leaders of the other 16 IC components came to Liberty Crossing for one last meeting, a reception that included martini service. I thanked all of them for all that they had done, and for the work that was still ahead under the new administration. Stephanie and I also hosted a mini-reception for many of our protective detail officers who had served us for the past 6 years. We both agreed that this was our most emotional farewell. These great men and women became part of our extended families, protecting us 24/7. They are wonderful people, professional, self-effacing, and dedicated, and always as respectful as possible of what little privacy we had. On Friday morning, the 20th of January, Sue and I had been invited to brunch at CIA Deputy Director David Cohen's home with John Brennan and his wife. We spent the morning and early afternoon eating, drinking, and laughing, and at noon noted that John, David, and I had all become private citizens. Early that afternoon, Deputy National Security Advisor Avril Haines and Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco joined us. They'd been working at the White House on the morning of the inauguration, almost right up until noon. We never turned on the Cohen's TV. For the first time since I started out as a scared second lieutenant in 1963, I left a job not thinking about what I would do next. I would turn 76 on March 14th, 11 years past when most people retire, never really having asked myself how long I wanted to work or when I'd stop, not until 2015 when Sue had become ill. In the years I was DNI, I'd never felt relieved of duty, not even knowing Stephanie O'Sullivan was at the helm, fully capable of handling everything. My personal security detail had been omnipresent, and I was always able to communicate with the national security structure. I had comms in the office. I had comms in the car. I had comms at home. If I traveled, a special comms team accompanied me. I was never out of touch and never able to completely relax. We have 6 years of vacation pictures in which I'm obviously not chilling out because I was always aware of the emails and cables piling up. At noon on January 20th, 2017, those obligations and all of that anxiety evaporated, much to my great relief. On Saturday, with a good bit of help, I packed up the office, making sure I kept track of the jar of paper clips I'd received from President Obama and all the other meaningful mementos I'd accumulated on the job. Now that the DNI's office was no longer mine, with no one pushing to keep me on schedule, no calls from the White House and Congress to push me off schedule, no briefings, no papers to sign, no emails to catch up on and answer over the weekend, the place finally felt calm and quiet. By Sunday afternoon, as I stood and looked at the bare walls and empty shelves, it finally felt real that my 55 years of service was over. I didn't regret its end. Life as a retiree took some adjustment. My first trip through self-checkout at the grocery store had all the makings of vaudeville comedy, and the short-term protective detail officer assigned to me seemed quite amused. I also had my grandson on speed dial for whenever I encountered IT difficulties. It's more than a little disconcerting to pivot from being a sought-after expert on national cybersecurity priorities to not being able to figure out where I'd saved a Word document before I closed the file. Some adjustments were pleasant, and cataract surgery was a life-changing event. Driving me home from Walter Reed, Sue asked why I was reading all the road signs aloud. "Because I can see them now," I replied. She glanced at me sideways without saying anything else. Vacationing in Antigua or just having morning coffee with Sue, I wondered what was so important that I hadn't found time to relax for so long. I did relax. But after a break, I continued making the rounds at colleges and universities, appealing to the next generation of U.S. voters and potential intelligence officers about the virtues of public service. I felt such engagements were an intelligence geezer obligation, and I watched from the outside as the new administration struggled to govern while contending with the new president's aversion to inconvenient facts. On his first full day in office, he sent his new press secretary out to address the media coverage of the inauguration. All the papers and cable news networks had run side-by-side pictures shot from the top of the Washington Monument. One showed President Obama's inauguration in 2009, with crowds packed into the National Mall and spilling out into the streets and sidewalks. And the other showed President Trump's inauguration in 2017, which was visibly more sparsely attended. Contrary to all the images and data, Sean Spicer berated the media for their coverage, announcing, "This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period," telling them the White House would hold them responsible for misrepresentations. He took no questions. An hour and a half later, President Trump was on camera at CIA headquarters. When I'd heard the first place he would visit as president was the CIA, I naively wondered if my appeal to his higher instincts had somehow had impact. No. He took to the microphone and began rambling about the dishonest media, the size of his inauguration crowd, and his belief that military and law enforcement people had voted for him en masse, lumping the CIA into those categories and saying, "Probably almost everybody in this room voted for me, but I will not ask you to raise your hands if you did. But I would guarantee a big portion, because we're all on the same wavelength, folks." He expressed his support of the IC with, "I want to say that there is nobody that feels stronger about the intelligence community and the CIA than Donald Trump. There's nobody." He briefly interrupted himself to say, "The wall behind me is very, very special," and then resumed his self-aggrandizing diatribe. The problem was that the sacred wall he was standing before, with its 125 stars representing fallen CIA officers, is the CIA's equivalent of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, not a place for politics or boasting. I considered putting out a statement, but John Brennan expressed that he was deeply saddened and angered, and that Trump should be ashamed of himself, and I felt that covered it. On Friday, January 27th, a week after stepping down, I went to FBI headquarters for a wonderful farewell from the Bureau. Just before the ceremony, I met briefly with Jim Comey in his office, and he mentioned that earlier that day he'd been invited to dinner at the White House with the President. My impression then was that he was uneasy about the invitation, and I hadn't seen much that made Jim uneasy in the past. He said that he hoped to impress upon the President the importance of an independent FBI and an independent FBI director, that they couldn't and shouldn't be buddies. I agreed, and I empathized with his difficult position. A few moments later, we were both on stage, and I told the FBI workforce that through all of the recent controversy, the Bureau, with their commitment to fidelity, bravery, integrity, remained a pillar of our democracy. Throughout President Trump's first week in office, people on both sides of the aisle appeared shocked as he actually began fulfilling his campaign promises through a series of executive orders. The most questionable, legally and morally, appeared to be the travel ban he signed on Friday. The order indefinitely blocked Syrian refugees from entering the United States and suspended entry of anyone from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen for 90 days. The president stated that the executive order was being issued to prevent terrorism, but to many people it echoed his call as a candidate for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. More than 60,000 visas were temporarily revoked, and hundreds of people were detained Friday after arriving in American airports, including U.S. green card holders and permanent residents returning from travel overseas, people who lived in the United States who were prevented from returning home. With the same signature, President Trump also ceded leadership on the Syrian refugee crisis to Europe. "We suddenly stopped helping those who were the true victims of the Islamic State and of Assad's regime supported by Russia." A national outcry followed over the weekend, with thousands of people protesting at airports where travelers were being detained without warrant or charges. People took to social media to protest, followed closely by a counter-protest in favor of detaining Muslims. I'd been a private citizen for a week and no longer had access to intelligence on what was happening, but I was well aware that Russian social media accounts had not been shut down, and felt certain their activities on Facebook and Twitter were leading the charge in stoking anger between Americans with differing political viewpoints. Meanwhile, President Trump, just like President-elect Trump, showed an aggressive indifference to getting to the bottom of the Russian interference in the election. He continued to deny that he or his campaign had any contacts with Russia, even as he fired Mike Flynn as National Security Advisor on February 13th, officially for misleading the vice president about conversations he'd had with the Russian ambassador. 3 days later, Trump tweeted, "The Democrats had to come up with a story as to why they lost the election, and so badly, 306. So they made up a story, Russia, fake news." On February 26th, he tweeted, "Russia talk is fake news put out by the Dems and played up by the media."